listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This past Tuesday's departmental press briefing at the Department of State covered a variety of topics, from hostilities between India and Pakistan to the unrest in Haiti and Venezuela, as well as peacemaking efforts in Syria, Afghanistan, and the Korean Peninsula. This was the State Department spokesperson Robert Palladino on Tuesday at the Department press briefing in Washington.
I've been traveling. Some of you have been traveling. That's right. And I have nothing for the top. So if there's any questions, I know it's a shocker. I know. Nothing to announce at the top. Sean, please, go right ahead.
Thanks. Can we begin with India and Pakistan?
Okay.
I know that there's a statement by Secretary Pompeo and by the White House after the attack in Kashmir.
Right.
India today was calling for credible and visible action by Pakistan against Jaish-e Mohammed, the militant group. I was wondering if the United States agrees with that and whether the United States has been in contact with the two sides about that or other aspects of this.
Let me start by saying, again, that we condemn in the strongest terms possible, the terrorist attack that occurred last week on an Indian Central Reserve Police Force convoy in the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir. We're committed to working with the Indian government to combat terrorism in all of its forms. And the perpetrator of that heinous act claimed allegiance to the United Nations designated Pakistan-based terrorist group, Jaish al-Mohammed, and we call on all countries to uphold their responsibilities pursuant to the United Nations Security Council resolutions to deny safe haven and support for terrorists. Do you have a second question there, too?
Well, to follow up on that, what would you like to see Pakistan specifically do in the case of Jaish-e Mohammed? Are there legal actions they could take in terms of detentions, in terms of prescribing organizations that could come after this attack?
We I believe you asked about whether we've been in touch with the two governments, and I can say that we have been in close communication with the government of India to express not only our condolences, but our strong support for India as it confronts this terrorism. And we you know, as you know, we have a close cooperative relationship with India, security relationship, and that includes counterterrorism operations. And so we're committed to working with India, the Indian government, and on these counterterrorism efforts, both bilaterally and multilaterally, including at the United Nations. As far as Pakistan goes, we've been in contact with Pakistan on this issue. We urge Pakistan to fully cooperate with the investigation into the attack, to punish anyone responsible.
You're in close contact. Could you say on whose part, is on the part of the secretary or other aspects?
I don't have further details on the level, but we call on all countries to uphold their responsibilities pursuant to the United Nations Security Council's to deny safe haven and support for terrorists. And that includes many things, as you know, freezing assets without delay, etc. All right, that's all. I have nothing. I don't have much more on that. No more on India. Let's move on to the next question. It's from Michelle.
Thank you. To housekeeping issues. Are you going to be the acting spokesperson? Who is the acting spokesperson? Is the State Department going to name one? Are you going to take over Heather's responsibilities?
We have no personnel announcements today. I am the deputy spokesperson, and I'm here to answer your questions. Anything further on that?
Well, my question was, who is doing Heather's job as spokesperson? You temporarily, or?
I am here answering your questions today, absolutely. Do you have a foreign policy question? And I'd be happy to answer.
These were housekeeping questions.
Sure, go ahead.
First out of the...
Okay, we all... Right.
Go ahead.
No. Is there anything else?
You were about to say something.
No, you were about to ask something.
Well, I wasn't clear on whether you are currently doing Heather Nauert's job as spokesperson or not.
I am the deputy spokesperson, and in that function, I fulfill many of the responsibilities that a spokesperson performs in any given federal agency. That includes... Please, she's still talking over here. Please, go ahead, Michelle.
And on the UN ambassadorship, is the State Department currently working with the White House on next steps on that? Or can you say what the next steps are from the perspective of the State Department?
That's for the White House to answer, not something we do from the State Department. Let's go to Fox.
One follow-up on India.
Please, right here, Fox. Go.
On Haiti, there are reports that 5 Americans were arrested on conspiracy charges there. I wanted to see if you had any comment on that, and if true, have they been granted consular access?
We've seen those reports. The Haitian National Police have detained a group of individuals, which includes some American citizens. Due to privacy considerations, we're unable to comment further, but I can say that whenever United States citizens are arrested, we seek consular access as soon as possible to provide appropriate consular relief. And then that's all I have on that. I'm not able to go beyond that for privacy considerations.
But you're not giving away any personal information if you say the number of Americans detained. That has nothing to do with individual privacy.
I've seen the press reports, but I have no further information that I can provide at this time. For any further information on numbers or questions related to the arrests, I would refer you to the Haitian National Police. Please.
We have one follow-up on India, please.
One follow-up. Another American, an ISIS fighter from Alabama named Hoda Muthana, is being held in a Kurdish detention camp and is being asked to return to the United States to face justice. CBP has referred to state. I wonder if you have any comment on that.
Yeah, I would say that the situation with American citizens or possible American citizens in Syria is by definition extremely complicated. And we're looking into these cases to better understand the details. But I'm not going to be able to comment publicly any further on that at this point due to privacy and security, for security reasons.
Can we go for one follow-up?
On follow-up, let's go over here, please.
When you say you're looking into the cases, you know, what are the possibilities that you're considering? Would you want her to receive jail time, send her to Guantanamo Bay or something like that?
I'm not speaking about any individual here. I'm not speaking about any individual case. I can speak generically about the situation in which American citizens or potential American citizens or alleged American citizens could find themselves in such a situation. And our policy in this regard would be, repatriate them. And that's what we call on all countries to do who have FTF fighters in Syria, too. So our position for other countries is the same as for our own. And we would that's a possibility. As far as Guantanamo goes, your question, the United States government is considering various alternative disposition options for foreign terrorist fighters who cannot be repatriated.
Non-U.S. citizens.
Go ahead.
Non-U.S. citizens, you're saying.
Correct.
And then just broadly speaking, not on her case individually, but for women who joined ISIS who may not have been fighters, would they also face criminal procedures back in the U.S.? Would you want them to repatriate to this country?
We've been clear on this, and we've spoken on this publicly recently. Repatriating these foreign terrorist fighters to their countries of origin, ensuring that they are prosecuted and detained, that's the best solution to preventing them from returning to the battlefield. We view these fighters as a global threat. And we seek global cooperation to resolve that threat.
So what is the State Department's take on the British decision to strip citizenship from the other ISIS wife?
I have nothing for you on that today. Please, let's go to Saeed, please.
Thank you, Robert. A couple of questions on the Palestinian issue. On the 17th, the Israeli army removed a Palestinian family from their home in East Jerusalem, in the old city. And they immediately replaced them by settlers. Did that bother you? I mean, your ally, the UK, issued a statement condemning this action. And at what point does it become ethnic cleansing? You know, when there's 10 homes or 20 homes or 30 homes, in your view?
I'm aware of that report, but I don't have any further details on it, so I would refer you to the government of Israel matter.
One more issue. The Israelis also deducted close to $140 million from Palestinian taxes. They're saying that concurs with the amount that the Palestinians pay the families of prisoners and fighters and so on. Do you agree with that, or is that considered some sort of a piracy by the Israelis? How do you term that?
I would refer you to the government of Israel for information regarding their transfer of customs revenue to the Palestinian Authority. That's for something for them to respond to, but I would say we condemn the abhorrent practice of Palestinian Authority payments to imprison terrorists and the families of terrorists.
And lastly, on the 4th of March, the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem will close its doors after 175 years. The Palestinians who have always went to the consulate for over these 175 years to get visas, to do their affairs, to immigrate to America, look after things and so on, will no longer be able to do that. Do you have any comment on that?
We have an embassy.
It's breaking a strong and deeply rooted American tradition.
We have an embassy in Jerusalem, as you know, and we have active involvement in all of Israel from our embassy. Please, Lori, go ahead.
Yes, could you explain what the latest is regarding the planned withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria? Have other countries stepped in and said they'll help out and replace the U.S. troops?
As President Trump has stated from the outset, the United States is withdrawing its forces from Syria in a manner that is deliberate and coordinated. And we're going to continue to work together to fight ISIS. And that's something that's going to continue. We have no timelines to discuss at the current time. But our new plan, Secretary Pompeo has spoken to this several times. The withdrawal of troops is a tactical change, but not a change in our mission. And our mission very much remains the same. And our commitment to ISIS's enduring defeat is both in the region and globally, that's not changing at all. We are, that mission set has not changed. As far as, what was your second part of the question, Lori?
It has to do with there's going to be a security, you're planning a security zone or a safe zone. There are many reports about that.
Right. We are actively engaging with Turkey on this, and that is part of our efforts to ensure a safe withdrawal of United States forces and a stabilized northeast Syria. It's also, you know, we take Turkey's legitimate security concerns seriously. We take them into account in our activities, and we have ongoing coordination. We're not going to discuss specifics on these talks, but they continue.
And are you still contemplating international observers or some others?
I'm not going to go into details on the discussions that we're currently having. Let's go right here, please.
North Korea, President Trump just said that, quote, as long as there is no testing, I am in no rush, end of quote. So is this an indication that there is no timeline of a CPID in the Korean Peninsula? And is the U.S. still planning to press North Korea for a CPID during the second summit?
Our policy goals haven't changed at all. Our special representative for North Korea, Steve Biegun, is traveling to Hanoi today. And he'll be continuing the United States preparations for the second summit that will take place next week. As far as our objectives, nothing's changed. And we remain confident in the commitments made by President Trump and Chairman Kim, that those commitments made at the Singapore summit will be fulfilled. And it's Chairman Kim's commitment to denuclearization upon which the world is focused right now, and that remains our goal.
Follow up
on North Korea. Let's go to North Korea.
Special Representative Biegun said that he would have another meeting with the North Koreans ahead of the summit. So will he be meeting with his counterpart while he is in Hanoi?
I have no further details on the meetings that he will be having at this time, but he is on his way today to return to have for preparations for next week's summit.
And when we're speaking to reports that have come out in the last 24 hours, is the idea of exchanging liaison officers with North Korea on the table as far as what could come out of this summit?
I'm not going to get ahead of diplomatic conversations or ahead of the president. A lot of things are being discussed, and we are very much looking forward to next week. Any more in North Korea? Let's go, Christina.
I want to ask you about the State Department's assessment of the current nuclear threat from North Korea. Understanding the Secretary has spoken a lot about progress, he says, has been made since the last summit, return of remains, lack of testing. But I'm wondering, can you quantify the State Department's stance on the current threat of the nuclear program? And I ask because this weekend on 60 Minutes, former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe said it's his understanding the President does not believe the intelligent assessments that the North Koreans can hit U.S. targets. So I'm just trying to figure out if the State Department, you know, is with the intel assessments or what our understanding of the president's position.
We take all of the intel, of course, into consideration. It's not something I'm going to talk about from the podium in a public setting. Statement of Department, we're focused on the policy, where we're trying to go. That's our strategy. And that is the focus of what's coming up right now and where we're looking. We have our approach is different, frankly, than what's happened in the past. This is a top-down approach that allows, you know, with the chairman and the president meeting directly, and that allows for a breadth of actions, frankly, that if successful could fundamentally transform relations between our two countries. So we remain optimistic going into this, and I'll stop there.
But I understand that, but are the State Department and the White House on the same page going into these negotiations about the current state of the North Korean nuclear?
100%. We're closely coordinated on all aspects. Yes, absolutely.
Last follow-up?
Okay, please. NHK.
After Biegun met with his counterparts in Pyongyang earlier this month, there were some reports that came out that said the U.S. had made an offer of declaration of non-aggression or a possible peace declaration. Could you comment or confirm that?
Yeah, I'm not going to go into details of private diplomatic conversations, but the Singapore summit last year, there were, four areas that the United States and North Korea are focused on. And, I'd add a fifth, and the fifth is a brighter future for the North Korean people as well. All of this is what we remain very much focused on. Thanks. Carol, please.
I'd like to talk about Venezuela a little bit. Yesterday in Miami, John Bolton told reporters that you might be using volunteers to get some of that aid in. I'm wondering if you're organizing people and if you're thinking church groups, or I was just hoping you could expand on that a little bit.
I don't have any further details, and I'd have to refer you to the National Security Council on that. But the message that the president delivered yesterday was clear, and millions of Venezuelans are starving and suffering, frankly, while a small handful at the top of the Maduro regime continue to plunder the nation into poverty and death. And we call on these individuals to think of their own people and to think of their own futures, and understand that they're risking both. I'll leave it at that. Sure.
Confirm whether Elliot Abrams has met with representatives of the Maduro government, whatever you guys are calling it now. Maduro himself said that Mr. Abrams met with the foreign minister, Arriaza. We saw your comment last week saying that would be expected that such conversations might occur, but could you just say yes or no whether those meetings have taken place?
We're focused on the security of our personnel in Venezuela, and part of that naturally would be to talk about those with the guns, frankly, and so we remain focused on ensuring the security of our personnel in Venezuela.
So can you just confirm whether those meetings have taken place?
Didn't we say that? Did you just tell me last week it was confirmed?
The statement did not say explicitly that those meetings were confirmed.
My understanding is we have had there has been one meeting, but I'd have to look further to get further detail on that.
How are the conversations with the government going on protection of life and property down there?
We continue to monitor this situation 24/7. There can be no higher priority for the Department of State than ensuring that our facilities and personnel are protected, and it's something that we'll continue to do. It's something that the Secretary of State remains very focused on, and we'll continue to keep it that way.
Are you expecting to see that aid move?
Too many. Hands. Okay, right here, please.
I just would like to go back to North Korea quickly. Steve Biegun said that the United States will take corresponding measures as North Korea start to denuclearize. Does the corresponding measure include sanction relief?
We've been clear on sanctions. These are the world's sanctions. And that is something that we're going to, you know, that is something that will be continue to be maintained until we've achieved our final result of the fully, finally verified denuclearization. But I don't want to get ahead on any further details on what's being negotiated regarding that question.
And how would you characterize the progress of the negotiation with North Korea right now? Is everything on schedule?
We're having a summit's going to take place next week. Steve Biegun is on his way back right now to tie up the remainder, and we're optimistic and looking forward to next week.
In Hanoi until the summit, or is
it? I have no further details on his travel at this time. Okay. Other than that.
LGBT issues?
LGBT issues.
Yeah, apparently there's this new push by the State Department to try to get other countries to decriminalize homosexuality. Can you talk about where that is right now and what exactly is this initiative?
I believe you're referring to a strategy meeting that MSNBC was reporting on out of Germany. That was in advance of a strategy meeting that Ambassador Grinnell and his staff at Embassy Berlin had today with 11 activists from different countries in Europe. You know, this really is not a big policy departure. This is longstanding. And it's bipartisan.
So would you characterize this as some new initiative or something? Or is it just a continuation or a intensification of efforts that the State Department does?
I would say that this is a good opportunity to listen and to discuss ideas about how the United States can advance decriminalization of homosexuality around the world. And that's been our policy.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, let's go to Afghanistan.
Nazira Karimi, Afghan independence journalist. Sir, as you know, the peace process in Afghanistan going on. Are you optimistic? Do you have any update? And also, Pakistan has been canceled the meeting with the Taliban. What was the reason?
We continue to facilitate a peace process that protects our national interests and brings all parties together in an intra-Afghan dialogue. The United States, our policy is that we support all steps that would lead to a genuine intra-Afghan dialogue, and that includes the Afghan government, the Taliban, and other Afghans. And we encourage all countries to support this peace process. Special Representative Khalilzad, he just left Kabul, and there he met with President Ghani, as you probably saw. He met with student groups. He met with civil society groups, including women and youth. And this is all part of our effort to have an inclusive intra-Afghan peace dialogue. And so that's something that the special representative will be continuing. He's currently in Turkey right now, and he's meeting with the Turkish government. I'll stop there. Okay, sure. Iran. Okay, let's try Iran.
Iran and Pakistan. That Iran is accusing Pakistan of terrorist attacks. And do you have any comments on that?
I don't, no.
And the Pakistani Prime Minister today said that even after you have given all the evidence from the UN and all, the Pakistani Prime Minister said that without hard evidence, he is not going to act on any terrorist organizations. And if India attacks, he is going to, you know, retaliate. So do you think there is a chance of escalation?
We call on all countries to uphold their responsibilities pursuant to United Nations Security Council resolutions to deny safe havens and support for terrorists.
And the Saudi prince, Crown Prince, was in Pakistan, and now today he's in India. Do you feel that What do you expect from that visit? Anything kind of a peacemaker?
I don't have anything on that visit to share at this time, please.
Nigeria?
I'm just kidding. Nigeria.
Nigeria.
Okay, something different. Thank you. Sean, what is your question about Nigeria?
Well, the elections were postponed.
Right.
I know that the embassy in Abuja released a statement in support of that move. Since then, the opposition has been saying that there potentially could be a plot to rig the election. Do you take these concerns seriously? Do you stand by the support for delaying the election? What would you like to see happen at this point?
Okay, so you're referring to this week-long delay that took place in the elections. This was something that the Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission announced. The United States calls on all Nigerians to maintain calm as the Electoral Commission finalizes its electoral preparations and to peacefully participate in the electoral process. We emphasize the importance of continuing to maintain the safety of election personnel and the integrity of all election materials. And we are confident that the delay in voting will not sway the commitment of the Nigerian people to free, transparent, and peaceful elections. Last question. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, on Syria, a Russian foreign minister has said that the U.S. plan in Syria is to split the country and divide it. Do you have any? What's the U.S. plan in Syria?
I think we spoke about that earlier, but I would say about the foreign minister's comments that that's a misrepresentation of United States policy. We support the unity and territorial integrity of Syria. And we've been clear that the only path in Syria is a political solution.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
I have the honor to still again interview Alistair Crook. He is a former EU diplomat and founder and director of Conflict Forums. This time, we will discuss the end of America's unipolar moment. Alistair, it's wonderful having you back in Moscow still again. The last two times we talked about the shifting sands of the Middle East. Now, in light of what Donald Trump's, or I think his America First is policy towards the world is taking on some flesh, we, depending on what variant you want, the John Bolton one or the Mike Pompeo, maybe the Elliot Abrams. But I have a sense that the unipolar moment is actually over, and it's the U.S. trying to comprehend that end. And it doesn't mean I know what's going to follow it, and maybe you can tell us.
Certainly. I think in a sense what's gone at the moment is not so much the hegemony is still lingering on, but what is completely gone is any sense of vision of the future, any sense of vision that would motivate the world to want to be American, to follow an American path. The idea of the order in which we lose our diversity and become a homogenous human, if you like, asleep population within an empire and an order and a coercion. To be similar. I think the vision is gone, but still the power, of course, lingers on after the vision has gone. And I think Mike Pompeo's speech in Cairo precisely showed it was completely disconnected from reality, disconnected from the region. I think most people in the region didn't know what he was talking about because they don't understand rapture politics of America, evangelical movement. And it was really more about the civil war that is taking place in America, or not a new civil war, perhaps, but actually a resurgence of the old civil war, where now the deplorables of the Confederates, and you have, if you like, the urban elites in New York and the other countries saying to them, you know, we have a moral position and you as they told the Confederates about the slaves, don't have a moderate moral position. If you like, blue virtue against red virtue. Mm. Both believe they're right. Both believe they have every truth on their side. And this is, I think, what Pompeo was speaking to, the coming conflict within the United States, more than anything else. So, I mean, where are we going? Oh, you're very right, because it's the same in Europe, in a sense. The Europeans have only one thing. They have the foot on the brake to try and stop populism, as they call it, or these new parties that are emerging, the threat at the European election. They have the foot on the brake. If they took it off, they wouldn't know which direction to drive. They have no vision except keep on with what we've been doing for the
even
last
though 50. It doesn't even come to any kind of positive fruition here.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about John Bolton, because you mentioned Mike Pompeo. I like that rapture perspective here. John Bolton isn't of that ilk. He's very different. I mean, while, you know, with the forced regime change going on in Venezuela, he was quite open what it's all about. It's about oil and trade and money. It's about pure hegemony without all the trappings of democracy promotion.
It's a very important point which you're making, and you're right. I mean, what we've seen is a split within the neoconservative movement, which hitherto had been quite unified. And you've got one wing of them, which are led by people like David Frum and others, which have always been anti-autocracy, anti-autocrats, or particularly Middle Eastern autocrats, and in favor of democracy as a way of reshaping society, cleansing it of the old model and preparing it for installing, if you like, a different model of society. And they have shifted and they've moved over to the Democrats and been embraced by American Democrats as a moral vision for the future. And Bolton and the others cling to old American thinking associated with Carl Schmitt, which is power.
Power.
What you keep is power. And it's very clear, and Schmitt was very clear and said, look, this isn't about morality or about values. That's for the theologians. We keep power. And any state that wants to survive has to destroy any rivals that appear in its way. So that is really the sort of more the Bolton view. Is not a grand vision, a grand sort of structure. It's about using power in a way to make sure America is first, America first. But I want to say, if I have a second, what I think is most striking at the moment is because Europe is so obsessed by proving their difference from Trump, that they actually now are embracing that other form of neoconservatism with the Democrats, along with the Democrats. So you get these amazing things where Europe supports regime change
in Venezuela.
After all, they should have learned from Libya. They still think that, you know, this is a good idea. You see Europeans saying, oh, well, I mean, you know, Assad should be punished for all that's gone before. We can't allow the Syrians to go back to a normal life.
Don't allow them to rebuild.
No, we can't have their houses back or anything because he did things that were malign in the past. So we have this sort of, if you like, morality grandstanding by Europe. On the lines of, if you like, the neoconservative wing that moved to the Democrats.
But, okay, if we look at the two different strains, and I think you're absolutely right, we can look at the Pompeo strain, we can look at the John Bolton strain, but empirically, neither one really works. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, forced regime change since the end of the Cold War doesn't have a very good track record, okay? And so I think you see these competing narratives here, but if you look at the level of success, it's not really there. So there's that tension there, but it seems to me these are retreads supporting the same policy that doesn't create positive outcomes. Countries do not become more democratic. They lose their sovereignty.
And they don't tend to be pro-American at the end, okay? I mean, we can look at the situation of Ukraine, for example, forced regime change there. What has it gotten, okay? It's not getting into the European Union. It's not getting into NATO. And it was certainly a punishment towards Russia. But I don't see forced regime change of either variant being successful.
I think, you know, really the model that underlies it, we look back in a few years and say, you know, how could we possibly have believed it? How could we believe that just endless debt was going to make us all richer in a real way, the whole people and the planet? The whole of this liberal vision was based on replacing sort of moral values by prosperity for all. We'd all be wealthier, better off, Europe would be prosperous, and it hasn't happened. And it hasn't happened for obvious reasons, because it was thought that if you create money and you create credit and debt, but if you go on doing that with no boundaries, with no limits to how much you can, and you just do more and more and more, you don't get real wealth. You get asset classes and stock markets that are sky high, but you get the wealth. It is, of course, that type of credit creation, a direct transfer of wealth from us, the general public, to the minority, because every time they print new money, they dilute the money that we have in our pocket, in the sense, and then it's intermediated through the banks into the financial markets.
But you get, as a result of all of that, even that doesn't work, because we have the Yellow Vest movement in France, and which is a demonstration effect for many other parts of Europe. We have the rise of the Trump electorate as a revolt against the system, against the status quo.
And this was the real breakdown. 2008, when instead of changing, they went on and created a whole pile of new debt. And we all know that beyond a certain point, new debt sends your economies to sleep. It did that to Japan and elsewhere. And so we've had a huge rise in new debt. And the economies have become zombie economies with no growth. But particularly this way of just creating debt and more debt to try and produce growth is having the opposite. The Yellow Jackets, Brexit, all of this is because the 60% haven't money. There are no savings. People can't afford to live in a decent way. It's not that they don't have prosperity. They don't even have enough to survive. 60% or more of Americans can't put their hand on $400 in an emergency.
But the popular term, the 1%, the ones that have real power, real economic power, access to media, access to politics, they're quite satisfied with this, and they've been insulated from it. I mean, this whole argument about walls in the United States. Well, liberals don't like walls, but they have walls around their palatial apartments and homes. That separation is important to them.
Because, you know, the system was designed by a few to benefit the few. And it was deliberately designed, the structure, this economic. It goes back to the 19th century. But this was a structure that was intended to put, I mean, Dostoevsky actually refers to it in one of his stories about Seville and the Grand Inquisitor. But it was a scheme which was intended to as a fantasy that would give people, the impression of prosperity and wealth, whereas actually it was about sending them to sleep and, if you like, controlling the population. Democracy never came into this. This was about a small inner circle of people who deliberately have constructed a system. This is not any sort of conspiracy theory. This is quite clearly visible in history, that this is what it was. It started in the 19th century. And we've had various sort of manifestations. The Bolshevik, if you like, Trotskyist revolution was part of these type of thinking and the structure that was
there. Hold that thought. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the end of the unipolar moment. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to our discussion on the end of the unipolar moment with Alistair Crook. And before we went to the break here, you were talking about the very disastrous situation for the middle class. And we have neoliberalism. It was basically constructed for the middle class. It was sold to the middle class to strengthen it and to continue it. But it's actually done just the opposite.
Yes. You know, and this is, I mean, why do we have Brexit and the Yellow Jackets? And one of the main reasons, only one, but the principal reason, was in the wake of 2008, the governments bailed out the financial system at huge cost and took it onto the government balance sheet. Then they had to bail out their balance, the government balance sheet. And they did that by eviscerating all the welfare systems, the social systems, the medical systems that were in place. And that has left people feeling very unsafe and very vulnerable because they wonder, you know, what happens if grandmother gets ill? How am I going to afford it? What will happen? Will she lose her house if she can't pay the rents? It's left people, if you like, alone in this jungle.
The promise was security and prosperity. That has always been the promise, and they have broken that promise.
Broken here. Both.
All right, I want to talk about going back to the unipolar moment here. We have this great historical challenge ahead. We have, while the United States and maybe elements of the neoconservative class in Europe look at Russia as the greatest threat, the real challenge on the global stage is the United States vis-a-vis China. And we have a Thucydides trap being played out here. How do you see that? Is it because we look at these trade agreements that Trump is pushing. I think they were, some of them are very, very appropriate in some cases here. But a lot of people will say historically that trade conflicts, trade wars lead to real wars.
No, I think there's a very clear parallel with this, and it goes back to the end of the 19th century, when it was actually at that time Britain, which was the unipolar power, and had a globalized, if you like, trading system, and then saw Germany rising, and saw
and
it
quickly.
Quickly and rapidly, and threatening Britain's position. And Britain in this responded to that, first of all, by trying to isolate Germany diplomatically, bringing Russia and France into alliance as a sort of vice to squeeze Germany as hard as it could. Then they tried trade sanctions. They blockaded the North Sea with warships so that food would not get to Germany in time. And it ended up, as you say, with war in it. But that is not really, I'm not trying to sort of project that from that experience, war between America and China is inevitable. But what is inevitable is also what happened at that time. Was it ripped apart, if you like, the root structure of the economic world? So technology is in our sphere. Chinese technology goes there. But it's more than just technology. It's going to be all sorts of supply routes and supply lines for it are going to be pulled apart and separated. It's going to make disruption and more expense. But the main thing was that after the armistice, the pause in the First World War and this long struggle, Germany rearmed to fight the Second World War. And in rearming, printed money galore, and we had inflation, depression in the 30s that only ended really with the Second World War. And what is America doing now? It's rearming massively. It wants to rearm the whole spectrum of its weapons, from space down to the soldier in the field with artificial intelligence across the board. Hugely.
Well, that goes back to this whole concept of where Donald Trump's America First fuses into the conventional sense of American exceptionalism. If we look at the confrontation going with China, you know, historically, if we look at the Thucydides trap, is that there are three things you can do. You can accommodate, or you, no, first of all, just allow it to rise, accommodate, and go to war. But because of America First, a la Donald Trump, and American exceptionalism, it takes accommodation off the table because you're ideologically possessed not to do that. And that's why I think confrontation is actually more of a reality. Because historically, you have options. There are options. That's why we call it the Thucydides trap.
You're exactly right. I mean, they are taking, you know, what they are trying to do, both to Russia and China, is to push it further and further into a corner and into a place where it never wanted to be. Russia did not want this relationship with Europe and America at all. It's tried all the time. It's been saying, let's open, let's talk. Let's talk about missiles. Let's talk about strategic security. And China has made clear that it is not wanting to go, but says if there's no choice, they will go to war. And they're clearly preparing for the possibility of war. But the whole idea of this power structure that, as I say, Bolton has, is that you don't allow the space for mediation. Carl Schmitt was very clear. You have to make your enemies so black, so devilish, so demonic that no liberal can even raise their hand and say, why don't we talk with them? Because how do you deal with evil? I mean, how do you talk to evil? I mean, that is the structure that is somewhere in the background. I'm not saying Bolton follows all of it, but it's back in the background.
But if we take accommodation off the table, then what does a military victory mean? I mean, with a major power like China, I mean, what is it, submission, complete destruction? I mean, China is the factory of the world. I mean, it seems to me that it's a glorified game of chicken, but it's very, very real because the Chinese, and we can just maybe throw in the Russians, they're very acutely aware of their sovereignty. Most of the world has lost their sovereignty, and the United States is demanding that people compromise its sovereignty for its hegemony. I don't see the Chinese doing that.
There is a very strong, what you say is quite correct, but there is a very strong perception in the United States that they have all the leverage, that they have the power, and that ultimately people will back down.
Isn't that delusional?
This is why, I don't know. I feel there is a confrontational mood in Washington and in parts of Europe. About Russia in parts of Europe. And I feel, in a sense, that I don't know what Russia or China can do as they get pushed further and further into a position they never wanted to be in. But where then are the options for Russia and where then are the options for China? China will not back down. The technological, this is written into the text of the Chinese Communist Party manifesto. It's now the destiny of China is to rise and become a first-rate power technologically. It doesn't mean belligerence, but it means they intend to and are going to. It's not something that is really going to be possible to stop. But all the tools that America is using, energy dominance, dominance of the financial system, technology. Yeah. But the energy dominance is intended to be able to contain China economically.
And Russia as well, if we look at Nord Stream initiatives.
And you see, therefore you see the blueprint. Iran is a blueprint.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it seems to me as this unipolar moment evaporates, accounts for the belligerence of the United States now, I think symbolizing the rhetoric coming out of John Bolton's mouth, is that we see this threatening rhetoric against Iran. It's always been there, but it's really been ratcheted up right now. And we have this also seeing China as a threat here. As the polar moment evaporates, to maintain that hegemony, there will be, on the table, as I always say, the use of force.
Yes, and I think Iran is an example. It's quite clear that they expect to be able to crush the economy and drive people into such poverty that they may rise up and overturn.
But we don't have historical evidence of that happening. Why do they continue down a path where the blueprints for those kinds of changes never come about?
I think because, I mean, one of the characteristics of this period has been, particularly in the West, a sense of certainty about their own mental constructions. I mean, there's
so
a
you
long
would,
history.
You would agree with my ideological possession?
I would. And what I'm saying is that, you know, for a long time, our peculiar way of thinking with unique causality, with singleness, demanding singleness of meaning. Iran is this. It isn't, you know, several layers to it. It is one meaning only. Our obsession with causality and unique causality, with singleness of meaning, and then seated in the Western ego, which sees itself as the only meaning given, giving structure.
Then you're blind to reality.
Yes. Then, you know, no, I know it. I've read it. I saw it in the Financial Times and The Economist. Iran is a dangerous actor. So, I mean, are you telling me they're wrong? You can't, you know, they don't open. They're not argue. Are you going to say we have 50% of the world's defense forces in America? Iran, are you going to tell me Iran is going to survive against America? Don't be ridiculous. This is a certainty that, and this is why I'm saying both in Europe and America, where at the moment where the vision has collapsed, they don't have a vision to say to young people, this is how you might like to live. This is what we're trying to offer anymore. It's just crude. The mask is gone. It's just a crude exercise in restoring the empire's power. And, you know, it's not going to work. And I think what I said about the German, British example is a forewarning that I'm not sure which will happen first, whether we'll end up in a conflict or we'll end up in a financial crisis. But the financial crisis is coming imminent. Very soon, America has been able to ignore it for 70 years, but now their borrowing requirement is calculated by leading financial experts. The borrowing requirement within 5 years will equate to 25% of American GDP. Who's going to pay that? Who's going to lend that much? One quarter of the
Those are debt levels possible. That will never be paid off. Okay,
and that's
why, in one way or another, we face doomsday. Alistair Crook with us all the time. We've had it's been a wonderful
thank
having you talk
much.
To us here
Pleasure.
At RT.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.